Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
Hey everyone, it's Yasir, and I'm calling today with a little favor to ask. Over the recent weeks and months, I've had loads of you get in touch with some great questions, and today I'm going to be trying something new with the show. I'm trialing a Q&A segment where I'll be joined by co-host and elite coach educator, Gerard Jones. Now, these are discussions which are going to be taking place every Sunday evening at 7:30 GMT, live on Twitter Space, if you wanted to get involved directly. Otherwise, I'll be releasing them here every Wednesday on the Coaches Network podcast. So for today's format, slightly different, and for around about 30 minutes, each discussion will be dedicated to a question that has been sent in, where myself and Gerard will be going into some real depth and sharing our views and opinions on the topic in order to leave you with some key takeaways to consider in your own environments. So the favour I'm asking for today, guys, is if you could let me know your thoughts on the new format, and you can do this by getting in touch on Twitter at TheCoachesNet. Once again, that is at TheCoachesNet. And of course, if you have a question, feel free to send that in too. Hope you enjoy the new format.
The Coaches Network, bringing the game together.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach, coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Just for a quick reminder, this is an FA accredited CPD as part of a series of spaces sessions that we're doing throughout the month of May around developing a 360 approach to 1v1. So Gerard, we'll deep dive straight in and I'll ask you, the art of 1v1, where does your mind go to straight away when you hear about this topic and the theme in particular? And where do you think coaches should kind of direct their attentions to from the get-go?
Well, it's a interesting topic, isn't it? Because we've spoke about this briefly even on the last game model webinar, where we talked about just the art of the 1v1. And often, you know, a lot of people talk about only in possession, but what about out of possession and defending and so forth? My mind just looks at the duels. I think about the individual tactics of a player, and I try and think about the duels and the matchup. So how can you get players to outplay, outthink in a 1v1, whether that be creatively when they're receiving the ball and the tactics to beat a player 1v1, whether that's to stay on the ball, dribble to eliminate, dribble to engage, or whether that's to receive and with their first touch eliminate pressure, right? So is it a touch move, or is it a protection touch, or is it an elimination touch? And then outside of that, you know, you've got some other player actions as well, but then you've also got the defending side of it, you know. That's a big part, and we spoke about that on the last Twitter space, didn't we? So, yeah, that's where my mind goes initially, is just looking at the duels, and then where on the field have you got certain matchups, and how are you sort of getting people to recognise those? What about your thoughts?
Yeah, no, it's not too dissimilar, to be fair. I'm just going to, you know, reflecting back on the conversation we had last week, and I'm touching on a few points that you've kind of raised there. It's, you know, the biggest ones for me is just almost recognizing that there's two elements, this 1v1, right? It's a yin and yang. Where there's opposition, there must be a defense and attack. So I think getting coaches, first of all, to start to think about it and look at it through that lens is a real key piece. And for me, I've then kind of
as time's gone on, started to ask myself, right, well, what are the key kind of components or elements or, if you like, inspirations when exploring a 1v1? I think in possession, it's looking at things such as, you know, how are you dribbling? You know, is there effective dribbling involved? You know, is speed and acceleration of the players, you know, utilizing body feints and fakes, you know, something that Paul McGuinness talks about a lot in terms of outwitting your opponent. How are you doing that? And obviously then there's a decision-making element in terms of observation of what's happening in front of you and around you to make a decision as to whether it's going to be a pass, a dribble to pass, a dribble to shoot, or a dribble just to take on. So I think there's a few different key bits in that as well. And obviously, you know, recognizing the awareness of the space around you that will fundamentally drive those decision-making factors. As well as something that you just touched on a few moments ago, you know, are you protecting the ball? Are you looking to do something with it? You know, from an in-possession perspective to start with, I guess from an out-of-possession perspective, some key kind of components or considerations, if you like, you know, how are you positioning yourself, maintaining that element of patience? You know, we talk about control and restraint as part of the principles of play. Looking at it from a more technical standpoint, how well or effective are you in terms of when, where, and how you jockey the players? You know, how good are you in terms of, well, you know, how well you can maybe read the game? And obviously the communication part of that comes into it as well, but also recognizing that the 1v1 is just a small piece of the jigsaw, right? So, I mean, there's a few different things where, in terms of where my mind's gone with it. I don't know what your initial thoughts are on that though.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? And just looking at Paul McGuinness and anyone, you know, recognizing that, I'll refer you back to the Twitter space we did last week, but also his work around under the microscope. So just imagining visually, it's hard because there's no image attached to this, but imagine a circle and then imagine you put a cross in the middle. So you've created almost a quadrant. So there's four quadrants. How are you looking at the individual tactics and strategies of players? Of how they're outwitting an opponent, whether it's what perceptual information they need to look for in order to make that movement into another quadrant. And it's really, that's the individual tactics. You know, often in coaching, we talk a lot about team tactics, team concepts, big word at the minute right now. The big buzzword is game model principles. And that is important. But part of that is, of course, decision making. You know, and often coaching is so focused on probably what's below the neck, but actually what's above the neck is really important, right? So what's happening in the brain, what information are players having to look for, search for, in order to solve a problem? And ultimately, the 1v1, the art of the 1v1, is really important because that's what the game is. The game is loads of these little duels all over the field. And for sure, there's a lot of 1v2s, isn't there, Yaz? There's 1v2s, there's 1v3s, there's 2v1s and so forth. But if we can get the players to be really good, technically, tactically, physically, understand how to make decisions when they're in those moments, isolated in a 1v1, because that's really where it'll break down. If they can make those really cool decisions, then the team concepts are probably going to get out better. And I think that's where coaches really need to lend their eye and be purposeful and intentional around what is it you're observing? You know, are you trying to see everything and see nothing? Where are you lending your eyes? And of course, I mean, we talked about this in maybe in previous episodes where we spoke a lot about the macro level, right? Where big picture, you're looking off the ball. We need to spend more time off the ball and around the ball and away from the ball. Whereas coaches tend to be drawn on the ball, with the art of the 1v1, perhaps this is lending more at the micro level, right? Where the observation is, let's just look at why did that player give that ball away, or not as the case may be. Why did we lose possession, or how did we gain possession? What happened in that little incident, in that circle of influence there, in that 1v1? And then what influences are there now away from the ball, around the ball, and those sort of areas that influence the on-the-ball stuff, right? The on-ball actions. Because ultimately, it's not the first defender you got to worry about. It's the second. It's the one after them. So are you developing players to think about those solutions? So this is where I think there's so much we can do. And really, the question comes to us is, how do you coach it? What are some of the strategies that people are thinking about to develop the art of the 1v1? You know, more often than not, the 1v1 is typically pressure faced up, right? Classical 1v1. Well, actually, how often does that happen? Is it dealing with pressure from behind or around? And actually, can you create little 1v1 games within a bigger game? So you're creating a, you've got a medium-sized game, small-sided game, or a large-sided game, depending on your numbers. But you're creating, you're thinking about the 1v1 duels within that practice, or you're creating another little game within that. What's your thoughts there, Yaz?
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting, right? Because, you know, we speak about this a lot, and I think we covered it in recent discussions, and even in our most recent webinar. And obviously, we'll unpack it in further detail in our next webinar. But it's literally just that, isn't it? Going back to what I said earlier about being a piece of the jigsaw, a small piece of the jigsaw. But, you know, don't just look at it as the 1v1. Look at it as, right, contextually, where is it? What is it? What is the purpose of the 1v1? Is it a 1v1, like I said, to take a player on with the intention to dribble and shoot? Is it a 1v1 with the intention to protect the ball and find a pass? Is it the intention to move the ball forward via a dribble, then a pass, as opposed to a shot? Does it change when it's actually a dribble and a cross? It's just, you know, when does a 1v1 begin and end in many respects? Because obviously you're talking about going from 1v1 to 1v2 to 1v3. They're all 1v1s, but in different contexts, in different moments. But they're also part of a timeline to some extent, because you're going in from one action to another action, and then going in from one scene to another scene as part of that timeline and that script of the game, if you like. But then I also then think, right, even if it is just 1v1 with a player faced up front, directly in front of me, well, what does that look like when we're in the defending third? What does it look like when we're in the midfield third? What does it look like when we're in the final third? What does it look like when we're out wide as opposed to being in central areas? So I think there's so many bits that you can go into within it. But I think it's first just getting coaches down the thought process of, right, what is the 1v1 moment that I'm looking to really explore here? And then kind of building on that, it's just looking at some of the techniques that you might want to coach within that, right? So in possession, is it a dribble? Is it a pass? Is it looking at how well they can shield the ball effectively, whether they can turn and whatnot. And it then brings you back to the point of discussion around unopposed activity. Well, where are you going to be practicing all these things in unopposed activity if you don't have the context? And if you're just teaching players... Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, just teaching players different turns, different body feints and whatnot. Yeah, but what's the moment that they're going to utilize this in? Is it a body feint to actually create space for a pass? Is it a body feint to create space for that cross or that shot? Actually, do you even use that body feint if you was in the defending third? And if you are, you know, I talk a lot about component pairings, right? Because you can't have one technical component that's isolated unless it's a dead ball situation. It just doesn't exist. So it's either going to be a pass and a receive and a pass, then a receive to a dribble maybe. So then now you've got receive and dribble, or you've got pass to shot. So it's receive and shot. So there's, you know, or finish, whatever you want to call it, but they're linked. You're never going to have a standalone technical component, right? So within the 1v1 situation, it's about what's the two technical components that are linked together in this moment. Am I receiving to dribble? Am I receiving, or am I dribbling to pass? Am I dribbling to finish? Am I passing to finish? And whatever else that might be. But actually then looking at the contextual factors of where it is on the pitch. But that's just in possession, right? We talked about this almost being a yin and yang situation. So what are the pieces that you're going to work on when you're out of possession? So what comes to mind for me is, you know, your body position and thinking about jockeying, types of tackle. So is it going to be a standing tackle, block tackle? Are you going to putting a slide tackle in? You know, what does that look like for you? You know, how are we using your arm and your shoulders and your body to kind of create and influence your position with additional pressures? So I think there's so many things that you can kind of really explore in this space that I think it's really dangerous for coaches just to assume it's one thing. I don't know what your thoughts are on that though.
Well, do you know what? There's so much there, and this is the detail, right? So I find it funny because there's often, and you haven't contradicted yourself, you know, typically when me and you speak, we're always sharing our experiences, right, and our different ideas, and this is what this space is about. It's not about this is the only way. It's about challenging each other, isn't it? It's about sharing ideas and this community and hopefully elevating the game, but having a rationale behind why we do what we do. And I find it fascinating because I was watching a session this week and the coach has done what I would say is a game-like experience throughout, right? He's designed different activities. He's created little duels within. But then right at the end, he contradicted himself. And he said to people, you know, I believe there's still a place for this technique and you've got to work in isolation. And, well, hang on a minute, you've just delivered, you know, a passing and receiving with different types of touches, how your first touches is getting into pressure, away from pressure, so engaging the opponent or beating the opponent, receiving on the back foot, front foot takes, back foot takes. And he did it with contextual interference, Yaz, where I was like, yes, I'm buzzing. And, you know, there was no immediate threat on the ball, so there's no direct opponent. But there was lots, if you imagine that there's multiple balls going and there's passing and receiving, it's chaos. And then he's introduced pressure, where as the ball's coming in, now you're under pressure, you've got to stay on the ball and things like that. You've got to find creative solutions to dribble you out of trouble or pass you out of trouble. And then he built it into, eventually we got bigger numbers. So he went more progressive. There's no right or wrong structure, right, in terms of your session design. Some do regressive, some do progressive structure, some do equal numbered. That's a topic for another space. He went progressive and eventually got into this, which I'm sure everyone's done, a 4v4 plus 3. So he's got 4v4 in the middle with three players, two either side, they're on the outside, but not on the sides, not the top, so front and back, and one in the middle to create that numerical overload. And then don't get me started on that because he talked about creating the overload. Well, you're not creating the overload if there's already an overload that exists. So at that point, you're exploiting the overload, but that's a topic for another day. But you imagine within the 4v4, then you had the plus three. So whoever's got the ball, they've got those extra players. There's loads of duels going on. There's loads of pressure. There's loads of players receiving where they're getting pressure from different areas. That 1v1, to your point, Yaz, looks very different. And where he had it situated on the field as a practice was very different as well. So you could do that same practice as a general practice, or you could do it as a specific practice. Where I find it fascinating is that these coaches tend to be so obsessed with technique, but they forget that all these actions have technique in them. And in order to make those decisions, in order to solve problems, adaptable solutions, there has to be some kind of a threat on the ball. There has to be some kind of opponent pressure. There has to be changing situations, that variability. We've talked before about repetition without repetition. So why I find it fascinating is that coaches have this conflicting paradigm in that we say, no, technique's important. Well, what is technique? Is it this pure, solid form of centered, you know, that's coach centered. So it's this technical model that's shaped by the coach. There's an ideal aesthetic way of how he wants you to perform that pass, that dribble, that shoot, that whatever, that turn, that twist. You talked about he has a fake. There's a lot of coaches out there that are, you know, it's like marketing. They're doing all these videos and like, oh yeah, back foot, do this, do that, dribbling out of this cone, quick Cruyff turn, do this, flippity flap, right, smack it in top corner. That's great. And you're forming that, but how are you forming those habits under pressure? Because there's a difference between explicit learning and implicit learning. Implicit learning doesn't break down under pressure, whereas explicit learning does. And when coaches have been found to have to design stuff where it's relying on their explicit rules of how to perform something, well, the challenge there is that the players aren't perceptually having to take on board information from an environment to come up with their own solution. They're constantly just repeating, they're regurgitating, they're reproducing what the coach has shown them or what another player's shown them. But that doesn't apply to every situation. Not every 1v1 is the same. So, you know, there's that video that we're going to show in the upcoming webinar where I still remember it, the Iron Robin piece that you did. Right, which I'd love you to share about, and it's the detail is excellent. And you think like Iron Robin was famously known for getting across people, right, and using his left foot. You look at Thierry Henry, how he used to come off the left and come inside. You think about Mbappe, how he'll play with disguise and deception. And really, you'd think that people know, right? They know what to expect because he does the same thing all the time, and he'll disguise his actions and finish near post or whatever he does. But they can't stop it. They can't stop it. But every one of those 1v1s was different, Yaz, right, wasn't it? It was different. The scenario was different. The context was different. The time in the game was different. The pressure was different. The environment was different. The weather was different. The surface of the grass was different. The opponent who he's playing against is different. So our job as coaches is, how do we design and recognize individual difference? So I'm trying to like summarize all those points into one, which is, can we recognize and plan for individual difference and individual differences within our training group, and put certain players against each other where they're going to pose problems for each other to try and solve? That 1v1 duel is almost like, it's use a phrase, or you're, lot, Yaz, don't you? We talk about like your yin and yang. My technique is in response to your technique, that famous quote from Bruce Lee. But that's it. Yaz might come at me in a certain way. I'm going to have to figure out another type of way of defending against him. And it won't always be the same. Whatever strategies I used before that might have got me success might not get me success in this scenario where I'm defending. And if he beats me, he's through on goal. And I'm defending perhaps in a certain area of the field, and I'm off balance, and he's affecting my foot placement because he's running at me and he's pausing me and he's getting across me with clever movements, clever touches. You don't have to form that. There's like this belief of training form activities where you're forming this technique and like myths around like muscle memory and all this. No, like what we should be thinking about is, how can we form habits that are more resistant to change? So if that opponent does something that we've never seen before, can your boy or girl figure out and adapt to that situation? Because we make decisions based on time, space, and number of variations. And there'll be coaches listening going, yeah, but surely I have to show them how to do a Cruyff turn, or how people forget that Cruyff did that move, not because someone showed him it, is because he was doing that in response to a problem that he saw on the pitch in that moment. And it just so happened that everyone saw that move and was like, wow, I'm going to copy that. I mean, how good must you be, right, if you get a turn named after you? But these players were doing these moves, you know, right at the start of time, but he came up with something different. Now, I see your hand up, so I'll pause on this one. Is our job as coach, think back to that first bullet point I said, individual differences. How can we create an environment where we're allowing players to be creative and explore their own solutions? But if we keep training them to reproduce something that we're giving them, well, that isn't creativity. All we're doing is we're just creating more clones for the game of yesterday. But how about we help them come up with something that we've never seen before? You know? Sorry, Yaz.
Yeah, I just want to... Well, first of all, apologies for stopping you there, because the thing is, there's so much detail in what you've gone into, and I'm really, you know, my mind's blowing at the moment, but I just want to kind of come back to that point about that Cruyff turn, or even what you talked about earlier, the YouTube clips of coaches breaking things, you know, showing techniques and whatever. I think that's all well and good as well, but it's also understanding this, right? If you're going to go down that route, can you coach it? Can you break it down for the players? Not just show them what they're doing, not just tell them what to do, but actually break it down for them. Examine the technique that you're going after and understand what that technique is a solution for, right? There's a problem that you're trying to solve with that technique. And what is the problem is the question for you to consider. Do your players know what the problem is? So that if you're giving them a bunch of tools, because I'm paraphrasing and generalizing an argument that's made for unopposed activity, right? Oh, these are all techniques that they're going to need to use in the game. And you may well be spot on, but how well can you break down and attach those techniques to the problems that they're actually solutions for? And that's the key thing for me. It's like, are you able to do that? And then beyond that, if you go back to the Arjen Robben piece, and I'm sure we'll unpack this further in the webinar when we get to it, and there's some, you know, really key insights that we can kind of delve into. But Arjen Robben doesn't do what Arjen Robben does because he did ball mastery. Arjen Robben does what Arjen Robben's able to do, well, was able to do in those moments, and probably still is, because he understands the situation that well. So it's not so much the technical aspect of it, but it's also the contextual aspect of it, right? And understanding that this is the moment I'm in, but actually looking at the profile and the observation piece around who's in front of me as a defender. Because in his mind, I guess to some extent, it's, I know what I can do, but who am I playing against is the question. So when it's against maybe an Ashley Cole, I might have to shift it and be a bit more, quote unquote, deceptive around what I'm trying to achieve here, and how, and the moment I seize that gap, if you like, As opposed to someone who might not be an Ashley Cole, who might be, I don't know, a Leighton Baines or even a Patrice Evra. They might be very different in that context, right? And really understanding the nature of the situation you're in so that you can understand that. Now, equally on the flip side of that, that's what the opposition are trying to do. You know, I think it was last season, Man City PSG, and you saw different ways in which Kyle Walker kind of pressed and, you know, engaged with Neymar. Actually, some of the pressure in the engagement that Kyle Walker gave him actually put Neymar off in some respects. So that deceptive element, that 1v1 and the art of it, you know, art of it is fundamentally both in and out of possession. So, you know, those are just some initial thoughts that are coming off the back of what you said. I don't know if you want to continue or you want to delve deeper into what I've just said.
Everything you said is bro, because you think about these matchups, right? And this is probably a great opportunity for coaches listening, going, well, how am I creating these matchups within my environment? And can I use the game as a reference? Because some of the players might not watch the game. So if we can mention, you just talked about two players there. If we can say those names, if we can say, hey, and this, you're going to play this position, you're going to play like Bellingham. So you're Jude Bellingham and your challenge is to do X, Y, Z. Or you're Harry Kane and your challenge is, can you finish low and hard from outside the box? Or your challenge is, you're Kyle Walker and I want you to press in this way or whatever it might be. Or you're Mbappe or you're Neymar and your challenge is, you're going to sit on the outside and get ready for the counter-attack. But I want to see explosivity. If we give players little challenges and related to player names by position, I think that is going to be so powerful because now we're inspiring players. So it comes back to that. How well do we inform? How well do we inspire? How well do we involve? And I think this is just another piece. You mentioned the Champions League there. You know, all this scenario-based coaching is about getting players to recognise what's in front of them. As much as we're trying to recognise who's in front of us, we have to create those scenarios for the players. And then I'm quite fascinated as we keep talking, you know, we've got Emmanuel. Obviously, you're with Blackburn Rovers in the foundation phase. We've got several people here. I'd be curious, you know, we've also got foundation phase lead at Leighton Orient and a few other clubs. What does it look like in your environment? You know, there's something we've been doing a lot recently. We've been doing a 1v1 curriculum at Sporting. But we also do where we'll have them receiving and dealing with different types of pressure. And we'll put them in different types of activities that basically are forcing them to outthink the opponent or play with deception. And we'll do that in a number of different ways, whether it's multi-skills, whether it's with a soccer ball, whatever it may be. And we've also done, where we've done 1v1 dual games, where we've, in the simplest way, small sided game, let's say you're playing a 4v4, 6v6, whatever you're playing. And if I think I mentioned this on the last space, when the team scores, they already know who they're in a 1v1 duel with. So there'll be balls lined up on the outside. You know, Yaz's team scored. So that all his team are going run, get the ball. We're the people who are defending first. Me and Yaz are just happen to be matched up against each other. You know, let's say Emmanuel's with Colum and so on. And then if every player, let's say you go for 10 seconds, 15 seconds, whatever you want. Every player, you got to stay on the ball for the maximum duration. By the end of the whistle, once the coach blows the whistle, if every one of your teammates, Yaz, has still got their ball, the goal stands. If they haven't, it's ball back to the outside, ball in the middle for kickoff, 0-0. So it's another element of creating competition. I'd be curious what other examples you have. You know, we're going to share that one, what you talked about. I don't know if you could describe it, you know, where it's the 360 and they're getting different scenarios, building on your comment earlier. And then I'm fascinated. We got Emmanuel who's about to speak, you know, I'm really curious, like, what does it look like in other environments? How are you developing these qualities? I don't know if you want to share anything, Yaz, on that 1v1 circuit, or if you want to just go straight into Emmanuel.
Yeah, let's deep dive straight into Emmanuel, because he might tie into some of the stuff. It'll be interesting to see whether there's anything alike in the other environments before, you know, I spill any thoughts on the work that I've been doing as well. Good evening, mate.
Good evening. I'm good, thank you. Hope you're all well. Thank you for having me. I think just listening, it's everything that's been said so far is just top, and it's really crucial, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, we're trying to develop individual players to think about these moments. And I think, look, the game at times goes down to those 1v1 moments, how can you outwit your opponent? And I think some of the things that we do, so in line with like the players' learning plans and stuff. So it might be if we're looking at staying compact or staying connected, and then moving as the ball moves. So it might be right as a fullback or whatever it might be, I need to stay connected, or a wide midfielder, I might need to stay connected, but still be aware of that pass going into here. So it might be simple things like you were saying before, painting that picture within that 1v1. And it might be as little as putting a mini goal in a certain area. So if their starting positions is wrong, you're going to get punished. So now I've got to think. I think it's around like the motor learning stages, I think it's called. So some players might be autonomous in 1v1 defending, but now they've got to think about maybe their acceleration and deceleration. So how you set it up encourages them to think, right, okay, so in these moments, this is my super strength. I use my body really well. But actually, how do I get to that moment to use my body really well? How do I accelerate and how do I deaccelerate in there to affect that in that situation? And I think, again, pairing players up as well creates like an elite environment, doesn't it, of learning. You go in best versus best, or area of development versus super strength, or whatever it is, to continue developing those players. So I think, yeah, everything that's been said so far, it's top. Because again, going back to what you said, Yaz, about, you know, moments where you're receiving to escape and things like that, it's like, what does your hips look like? Are you scanning to see how the opposition player, the direct opposition, how are they pressing, how are they running, are they pressing you a certain way? Does that influence where my first touch is going to go? Like Paul McGuinness says, going against the flow and things like that. So you're encouraging, depending on how you settle that 1v1, they're picking up so many things, you know, scanning before, during and after, to try and make effective decisions.
I think you're spot on. And then I just want to, first of all, thank you for sharing your thoughts and your insights on that. And I think there's a lot that you've touched on in there as well. And I think you mentioned there about, you know, the idea that us as coaches want to develop individuals in it. And I've just put a challenge out there. I don't know if how many people actually do what they say they're trying to do, if that makes sense. And I think if you actually take a second just to reflect back, you know, how do you justify and prove that what you're doing is actually supporting that intention of developing individuals, if that is what you're going after? And then just touching on the last piece that you talked about there, Emmanuel, is in that scanning piece. I think is so key, right? Because we talk about scanning all the time. It's probably the most used word in football, even more than football itself. And I think it's not, you know, I don't see a problem with using the word, but the challenge I throw out to coaches again is, well, what are we referring to when we're talking about scanning? Now, are we talking about just the simplicity of checking your shoulders, which is what many coaches do often look at, right? Actually, how do we perceive and how do we quantify a scan taking place? And then furthermore, how, you know, what steps are you taking as coaches? And I'm, you know, it's not easy. It's not easy at all. But what steps are you taking as coaches to actually understand what is an effective scan for the individuals that you're working with? What are they looking for? Why are they looking for what they're looking for? How much work is going into us as coaches helping the players understand what the things are that maybe they should or could be looking for in any given moment of the game, but also recognising that in different parts of that jigsaw of the game, whether it's a 1v1 in the defending third, the final third, the midfield third, in the wide area, the central area, with the ball coming in front of you, to the side of you, or from behind you, what does it look like in those moments? You know, and again, there's so much in there. And I'm not saying there's right or wrong answers, but what I am just putting out there and really trying to get coaches to think about and challenge them to think about is, how much work are we really doing with the players around 1v1s, if that's something that's really pivotal to what we say is our game model, our philosophy, our approach to working with players? How much work are we actually doing and then checking and challenging whether it's actually been effective or useful, or is it just our perception that's telling us because we've done something it must have worked? Gerard, I don't know what your thoughts are on that initially.
Yeah, I like what you said, what you both said, especially Emmanuel's point. So where my mind's going is, where are the players attending to? So if you think about coaching points, really, it's like we the session plan itself shouldn't be sequential. It should, yes, there should be some order to what we're planning. There should be some rationale. But ultimately, we need to. But really, our job is to design these game problems, right? So what's the identified game situation scenario that we're trying to relate to?
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Then what's the desired behavior? Now, if we think about it through the lens of the player, what does the player need to see in order to solve that problem? So if we start to think about their eyes and their experiences, we can start to, as coaches, try to train our eyes in, okay, what cues and triggers may that player need to see? Is it Emmanuel's posture? Is it his body shape? Is it the eye contact? So it's not just scanning for scanning, looking for looking's sake, as we've talked about and what you mentioned there. Like, a lot of coaches will say, hey, check your shoulder. Yeah, but what am I attending to? What am I looking for? So before you receive the ball, what's the movement of the number nine? What might you need to notice before that ball arrives to your feet? After the ball arrives to your feet, what might you need to do? At what points are you looking for information? How are you making sure you're gathering as much information as possible when they're touching the ball? And how are you looking for information in between contacts? You know, there's so much in it. And I think, you know, an interesting one, if we just think simply, is, well, if we know that the game's based on this information, does the activities that we're designing provide that information for the players? So if we've got an activity that doesn't have that pressure, or there isn't that consequence, right, to the action, based on where the ball might go, well, then potentially there's no choices being made. And then equally, there's no, what the information that the players are looking for isn't relevant to what they need to see in a real game. How can we create as close to the game as possible?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And, you know, I think really it's something that I talk about a lot. You know, are the game-like variables there? And not the way, and not because there is players in opposition, but are the game-like variables there in the sense that are they being presented in the same way they would look in a game? And this is coming back to the whole piece around representative design, right? Are we designing practices? Are we designing activities? Or are we putting on games that challenge and encourage the players to look for what they would see in a game? So, just because you're passing from A to B doesn't mean, and just because in the context of let's go down the route of unopposed activity, right? If I pass the ball from A to B, yes, you can argue that I'm making a pass, but actually you can't argue that I'm making a pass in the context of what it looks like in a game. And if it was, you know, that's fine too, but then you've got to look around what moments of the game would I get this unopposed pass in? Would I actually see it in a forward, you know, in a forward pass, or would I see it more in a pass where that's taking me from left to right, if that makes sense? So I think it's just understanding the context and then how much of what your player's diet is going to be in a game are you giving them to experience and taste in training? right? Because at the end of the day, that's what's going to play a pivotal role. And if you're not giving it to them in that game-like fashion, in a way that it would materialize and, you know, and demonstrate itself in a game, then you're not coaching anything other than a concept. And this is the one thing I talk about a lot, is if it's unrealistic, and let's go back to the three R's. We talk about the three R's: realism, relevance, repetition. Well, the one thing that's non-negotiable is whatever you do, it needs to be relevant. It needs to have relevance to your players, right? And that's not up for debate. That's just, you know, if it's not relevant, then why the hell are you doing it? And actually, inadvertently, what you'll also get is, if it is relevant, your players will be engaged. But it's your job and your challenge on you as a coach to make sure that your players understand the relevance of what they're doing, and you'll crack the engagement. Because sometimes we have a challenge, right, where we say, oh, the players aren't understanding it, or the players aren't listening, or they're not engaging. But well, actually, the only reason they're probably not going to engage is because they don't see the relevance for them. So even if they don't like the activity, if they see the relevance of it, the chances are they probably end up doing it. Now, at the same time, doesn't mean just go and do everything you want whenever you want and make sure that the players understand the relevance of it, because it's not everything's going to be relevant. And if you can't justify the relevance of it, probably not going to get there. So like I said, relevance, non-negotiable. The bit that you've got to decide on, though, is, are you going to go after repetition or are you going to go after realism? Now, if you're going to go after realism, then you're going to get limited repetitions. But what you will get repetition of, and something that you touched on earlier, Gerard, is that repetition without repetition. For anyone that's kind of heard that phrase before and is not too sure what it's meant, or if you're hearing that phrase for the first time, that repetition without repetition, I'd say you're getting repetition, but you're going to get repetition of the scenario that you're experiencing rather than the solution that you're being asked to utilize. And that's the first piece. The second piece, in terms of, I'm conscious we've got a couple of hands up, I just want to finish off this last point, is if you're going after the repetition, then just accept that you're going to lose some realism. Because if you're losing realism, what you can teach is the concept, i.e., as an example, you might do a rondo and get lots of repetition of passing, lots of repetition of pressure and cover. Because it's out of context, you're just teaching a concept and not the realistic aspect of what it looks like to pressure and cover, unless you bring direction into it, in which case you bring it closer to realism and further away from repetition, and then you start getting a bit more out of it and more bang for your buck in terms of transference. I'm conscious I've said a lot there. So I'm just going to open it up and I'll start with you, Gerard, and then we'll head over to Emmanuel.
Yeah, and I think I'd be to hear what Emmanuel's got to say. He might be thinking similar to me. I know exactly the point you're making. It's correct in terms of if you're going to go down, if you're going to include, oh, sorry, I'm reconnecting.
You there, Gerard? Emmanuel, do you want to just jump in while we wait for Gerard to come back in?
Yeah, no worries. I was just going to say as well, you know, in terms of earlier you mentioned around creating an environment. So if you're going after repetition or realism, I think sometimes I've been guilty of it in the past. When I started my coaching journey, sometimes you might be doing a certain thing, but how many times the coaches get into a game and then they might be doing 1v1 dribbling and different receiving to outwit your opponent, or different disguises on your forward moves or whatever it might be. And then they get into games and it's like, you should have passed it there, but you've spent all week or that training session working on aspects. I think if you're going to go after certain things, you got to be brave as well to allow these things to happen, because from those mistakes or from those moments where it doesn't quite work, when you've got your observation eyes on, it might be, right, okay, there wasn't enough disguise in that forward move or whatever they were doing in that situation. Maybe there wasn't enough barriers put up when they were trying to protect the ball. They weren't protecting it on the right side and things like that. So you've got to be brave and allow these things to happen for them to continue learning.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I think just some other considerations to kind of throw in there, right, in terms of the repetition piece. And I think if you're going after repetition, chances are it's out of the context of the game. And the hardest part to kind of really get them to understand then is the when and the where. Because if it's just out of context, you're not going to get that when and the where. You need the game, you need game-like variables to show you that. And you need game-like variables to bring that to life and bring the context to it, so the players can start to assess, oh, actually, cool, this is when I will do this and this is when I won't do this. And, you know, it goes off, it kind of brings up that, you know, that age-old saying of coaching the what-if moments. So what happens if this and what happens if that, as an example. So I think there's a good point in there. I think it's just to consider, right, what are we going after? And then, like I said, if you can coach the players when and when not to do it, I think you're probably onto a better path, in my opinion, rather than just coaching them all the what's. And this is what I talk about a lot. I think coaches need to move away from the what and start coaching the when, the where, the why. And then the hardest bit to coach, and this is the bit that I want coaches to think about as well, is if you're going to go down the unopposed route, no one's saying don't do that. Although it wouldn't be my recommendation, but you better be prepared that you're going to have to go in and coach the how, which is probably the hardest bit to coach. But we seem to have people ready to jump in at that early end of the spectrum in terms of unopposed activity, but not willing to actually coach the how because of either not knowing how to coach it or just not addressing it because they think it's bog standard stuff and that everyone should get it. So I think there's just a few thoughts on there, but can just you, really, really useful.
Can you hear me okay, Yas?
Yeah, got you, Nigel. Go
so,
for it, man.
Sorry, I was just going to say, well, and even just piggybacking off what you said then. So obviously there's that continuum where we've talked about your earlier point, right? So people might think, okay, if it's more realistic and more game, like the repetitions go down. And I actually would counter, and I'm not disagreeing with you because that's one way of looking at it. I want to say to the room is that there's a difference between repetitions and meaningful repetitions, which sort of piggybacks off what we were saying before, wasn't it? Yeah. So in the perspective I'm going is I don't think repetitions and realism are mutually exclusive from one another. If we perceive it that actually I need to perceive in order to act and I need to act in order to perceive. So there's that mutuality between perception and action. So I take on board information and equally whatever you do and how you change the scenario affects me and vice versa. How I respond to you affects you. Well, that mutuality, if we recognize that, we recognize that the game is unpredictable and so on. Well, then actually you can create this, as we've said before, this repetition without repetition, where the repetitions might not be as high. I mean, you can still design practices where they are pretty high, but they're happening under different and changing situations. So you're still getting repetition of a player action, a principle, whatever it may be, that scenario. But there's times where he's running across him. There's times where he's dealing with pressure faced up. There's times where he's getting a ball from, you know, from one source. There might be times where he's having to get the ball from a throw-in or from a different source. The ball's coming at different entry points. You know, and we talked about this in the last webinar, didn't we? And I think Emmanuel touched on it a little bit as well, which is where does your practice start and end? And I know that's something that you did a lot on the last webinar, yeah. So I think this understanding of really practice design, activity design is key. Because if we think about our activities and we think about, hey, if we're designing these problems with the mind that it might not always happen, but it'll happen in infrequent moments, which is like the game, right? But the quality of those repetitions is higher, and it's not repetition with repetition, but it's repetition without repetition, meaning that you're getting it under different situations. So you're having to form these adaptable solutions in a different way every time. That, to me, is going to be where the magic happens. And that's where I think as coaches we can start to develop players through these qualities. And then, you know, the last thing that, you know, Manuel was even touching on when he just added on, what are we looking for and how do we plan those problems for the players? And can we co-design that? So I'd piggyback off his last point and go, just imagine how powerful this experience would be if we took Yaz in a duel versus Emmanuel in that 1v1, and it's happening in a different way, but imagine if we could co-design what the rules of that practice are. So how does Emmanuel score and use his super strength? And how does Yaz score and use his super strength against Emmanuel? And how can we create that within the bigger picture of the game? So we link it back to the game. Now, if we stay as close to the game as possible, actually, we're going to create a lot of really cool repetitions of stuff. But it didn't have to be that they're doing the same thing over and over again. But that transferability to a practice is poor because there's limited understanding of the how. So, you know, just to sort of close up what you were saying, Yaz, it's not so much the what for me. It's more the how to, not the what to. And for the players, it's, you know, there's knowledge of and knowledge in, and we can go down many different roles, many different roads. But I would say that for coaches listening, just have a think that searching, when we talk about scanning, searching, this is a process of learning to tend to specifying information that's going to help players. It's that understanding of what do they need to see that's specific to their, where they are in that scenario. So actually, the more specific we are in our practice design, the better we're going to be for developing these players, because as individuals explore, they're coming up with their own solutions to these specific game performance problems that's allowing them to form their own unique and adaptable movement solutions. But as I said, like the traditional sort of contemporary linear approach to how we typically coach players is that we reduce the demands of the game for players through these multiple repetitions of a single skill where there's no opponents, it's constant, it's not variable or random. And in these sort of drill type activity where there's no active decision making, there may be some initial, what coaches might think is like a performance improvement, because they've seen the players basically model and regurgitate what we want them to do. But that doesn't mean that learnings took place. And we actually know that it's actually been significantly found to not promote a positive transfer to game intelligence, skillful and adaptable movement solutions, skills from practice to competition when you work in that way, because effectively we're imposing these artificial constraints and demands on how players have to move, which in turn is producing these sort of temporary, inefficient movement solutions. So if we focus more on repetition with repetition, we're developing players to explore, discover, and find their own solution to problems. Sorry, there's a lot in there, but I'm just trying to sort of tie in the repetition piece.
Yeah, 100%. There's only one line that I'd kind of just lend here and build on what you've just said and then pass it over to Rudy. But in that's, you talked there about the problems that we want to create. And I think this is where, probably just to simplify it for coaches really, Gerard. I don't think it's a case of even creating problems. I think coaches, what the challenge should be for us, and really, I say us because I think it applies to all of us. Let's spend less time asking us what problems do we want to create and asking probably better, what problems are we going to select from the game? Because they're already there. And if you're finding you're having to create the problem in the first place, and I just want to, and it's a play on words more than anything else. But if you select the problems that exist, and to start with, you're going to have to be observing the game itself first. Ask yourself, what is the problem, or what are the problems that my players are facing in their game? And to go back to that phrase that I use, make sure you're observing the game through their experiences and not your eyes. You need to understand what they perceive the problem to be, because we might see something from the side and be like, well, that looks like a problem. But actually, the player in the moment, they ain't feeling an ounce of pressure within it. Or they might not even assess it as a problem. So therefore, your interpretation of a problem and their interpretation of a problem could be two worlds apart. So just, again, rather than thinking about what problems can you create, what are the problems which have already been created, and which ones are you going to select from the game that your players are playing, is what I would say. Rudy, good evening. How's it going, man?
Not too bad, Coach Yaz. All good here, man. All good. Just chilling. Great subject, the 1v1s. I love 1v1s, and I'm really enjoying the discussion regarding it. Something that I've come across as a coach and working with various coaches, I think 1v1s are really, really important, and there's so much you can get out of doing 1v1s, as you've already alluded to about defending, attacking, and also looking on the transition. And the game is, as was said earlier on, about duels, 1v1 duels in many instances around the pitch. I do try, when I'm, as I said, working with coaches, try to get them to do that, because many of them don't think about the 1v1s. They, as you said earlier on, about doing the technical stuff, ball mastery, but forget about that particular element. And there's something I'd like to add on it as well. Players, when they get introduced to doing 1v1s in whatever grids, formation stuff, they really tend to enjoy doing it. It's a fun thing to do, to see it, to compete against somebody else and see if I've got the beating of them in various ways. And the last bit on that, I'll add on it, is that it's a great fitness thing as well. If you're looking to add to condition your players, working in those grids, working on Pacific time, they can. You can also cover that area, if that makes sense, in terms of working with the fitness of with players. I think it's really, really good. I think 1v1s are a key component of when we're doing training and practicing the various elements of the game, various areas. So back over to you, Coach Yaz.
No, really, Rudy, I think you're spot on. I think, you know, just there is that, isn't it? It's, you're getting the engagement. They're enjoying it because they're always involved in the action. So then it kind of brings us on to the point of, you know, ball rolling time. How much time are your players actually training as opposed to how much time have they been attending? And I think it's just really something to think about. Gerard, just interested to kind of get your thoughts on this in terms of what are the perceptions of the 1v1 from different parts of the world? Obviously, you've been around the world. You know, me and you, I think we've got many alike thoughts on a lot of what we talk about when it comes to coaching, but some challenging differences at times as well. But from your perceptions around the world, what's the take, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's very fascinating. A lot of it depends on where the coach is in the journey, right? Because if you're, even like if you were to ask me, and I'm sure you'd be the same in this, Yaz, and most people listening, if you'd have asked us like, hey, take a slice of the game, think about a 1v1, where would their mind go? It may go straight to dribbling. It may go to the, what we think is the classical 1v1, where there's someone running at someone and effectively the faced up pressure. But actually there's many different ways. I think in the US, there's a lot of the activities that I see when people talk about one-on-one is that faced up, you know, defenders passing the ball to the attacker. So effectively they're giving the ball away, or the attacker's passing to the defender to become the defender, whatever it may be. And there's that 1v1 immediate where they're both facing each other. I've tried to introduce different ideas where it's, hey, can you think about how players may start already in the activity and they're dealing with pressure from behind or around? So what's their movement, their cue that as that ball travels, they're making a movement to receive. But equally, as that ball goes into the receiving player, that's a cue for the defender. So they're traveling at the speed the ball travels to apply pressure. Or are they thinking, this is something I can intercept? Or they're thinking, no, actually, if I go steaming in here, he's going to beat me. So I'm going to go and engage, but I'm going to have to try a different tactic and slow him down because I'm worried, you know, or whatever it may, all depends on distance and timing, right? I think when I've seen 1v1s, when I think about my time in Morocco, I saw a lot more explosive activities where there was 1v1, but it was like individualized within a bigger picture. Yeah. So there was a lot more sort of tactical elements going on. There was positional possession. There was activities where, I mean, I mentioned one before, like a standard breaking lines, 4v4 plus 3, whatever it may be. But there's different types of little duels and matchups within that. I've seen it where there's times where players are deliberately put against somebody and the 1v1 changes depending on where players move in and out of space to affect people within an activity. So there's lots of rotation balance, lots of use of grids, not to restrict, because if, you know, we've already seen that where sometimes you put this invisible wall and you put a line and you're like, nope, you can't go into that area. Players are like, oh, you know, and you're taking away some realism of the game, right? Whereas and I'm not saying you can't do those activities, but you've always got to be mindful of the trade-off. Whereas what I saw a lot in Morocco was a lot more unit-specific, team-specific training, but then there was individualized coaching within that, Yaz. So they were thinking about the matchups, whether it was, hey, I need a, I'll give two examples here. The number six dealing with the number 10. And we know we're playing against Ghana. And Ghana have this decent number 10 who's going to cause problems. Or you could flip it the other way where we've got one of our players who's going to play with a 10 as a point up.
but then their six is going to be someone that, you know, follows you all over the pitch. But our 10 isn't very good at that. They're not very good at dealing with pressure immediately from behind and someone that's just going to just man mark them. Okay. So then what strategies are you doing to either be a decoy and make a run to deceive and create space to your teammates? Or are you making a movement for yourself to receive? Are you dragging them out to attract, to break away? Like, what are you doing in that little area? And then I've also done practices. I still remember Oshan, not to name drop, but, you know, Oshan obviously is with Cesc Fabregas now and they've just got promoted, aren't they, to Serie A with Como. I still remember on the, I think this was the A license. It was either the A license course or the A youth that I was the course director for. It was the A youth. It was the A youth course. And, basically coned the field off. So you imagine a phase of play, right? If everyone can visualize this, where it's a half pitch practice, attack v defense, right? The go to what most people have done. So attack v defense, full width up to the halfway or maybe beyond the halfway. But instead of on the right side where your number seven plays against a number three, let's say, if they've got a back four, instead of having that whole channel where you can just beat the player on the outside, Osh funneled it. Yes, he did like a diagonal line going across from the 6 yard box out to the sideline. So basically eliminated the opportunity for the seven to beat the player down the outside. So because of that line, he's constrained the player, the number seven, that in that 1v1 duel or 1v2, whatever it may be, he's got to come inside. So there might be times where he receives inside, a bit like a De Bruyne in a half space, and he's delivering early entries into the penalty area. Or he's dribbling across people, so he's driving on the inside. He's looking to connect and combine with one of the forwards. Or he's just getting across people, right? But he can't beat you like the classical, you know, and if you think about where crosses come from now, they're typically not always coming from those wide areas like they used to back in the day. It's coming from inside areas. So he forced that problem based on a game, based on how he's designed the manipulated the practice design, right? The task. But on the left, Yaz, he didn't cone it off. So for the number seven, there was that individual challenge where he's being forced inside. But for the 11, he could go down the outside or the inside. He could do whatever he wants based on the space available and what the problem is. I find that really, really fascinating. And I've obviously stolen it and I've tweaked it and done little things with it. And the reason why I like it is because it's individual difference. So on one side, it's very clearly different. So whoever's in that 1v1 in that area, they've got different problems. They're having to search for different information, but that's coupled, right? So even for the defenders, nobody wants to allow a player to come and drive in the inside for obvious reasons. You could, you know, you want to protect the central spaces. You don't want them to play that ball through. You don't want them to have a shot outside the area. So it's actually constraining the defender to deal with that problem of what if they've got a left footer on the right, right? Or they've got somebody who's just very good at driving across you and they're coming in. How do you deal with it? So I just wanted to say that, Yaz, if like there's a 1v1 that I've seen in different parts of the world where there's different lenses on it. I was quite impressed with Morocco and some other countries where it was a lot more personalized coaching. And I think that's obviously, you know, like a youth type stuff.
Sounds like Arjen Robbins and me, mate. But nah, good stuff, good stuff. Gerard, any final thoughts before we look to wrap up? And I guess more specifically, most useful takeaways that you think coaches should really think about off the back of this discussion?
Well, first of all, obviously it's an FA accredited CPD. It's so great to see so many new faces, you know, to have Rudy, to have Emmanuel speaking, different people, different ideas. So this is what we want. And again, if there's anything that pops into people's mind that they want to throw out there, whether it's a question, a comment or a challenge, you know, let's keep this conversation going even after the space. It is an FA accredited CPD event. So shortly I'll share a link. Actually Yaz has already done it. So he's already shared the link a few minutes ago. So if you click on that link, it'll allow you to fill in the self-reflection form. And all you'll do, make sure you put your correct name, spelling, email address associated with your fan profile if you're looking to gain their face, EPD, what your fan number is, and again, what are the key messages for you, and that'll enable you to have at least 1 hour CPD. So really important. And again, just key messages from me as we wrap up. How can you individualize the learning experience for players? So personalized and connected learning experiences. How can you think about the 1v1 through their eyes? What do they need to attend to when we're thinking about searching for information? So what does the player need to attend to? And then again, how is that helping you guide your questions better? So when you're interacting with players and you're thinking about your coach interactions, how are you helping them across those areas such as scanning, timing, movement, positioning? What questions might you need to ask? Whether that be in the design of the practice, whether that be in the rules that you introduce, the conditions, the rewards, the method of scoring that create that 1v1 problem for the players to solve. So there's lots for me that we spoke about today, and I think this has been one of my favourite discussions.
Yeah, most definitely. I think the same for me, really. I think, you know, just a couple of things to kind of just add on and just build on to all the takeaways that you've just shared is just those two key questions. One, let's step away from asking us what, you know, asking what game problems we're going to create and asking what game problems are we going to select from the game that our players play. That's probably that's the first major one for me. And I think two, it's, are you going to dive down the route of realism or repetition and understanding that repetition can still be achieved? So is it the numbers of repetition that you're after? Or quality of repetition that you're after. And for me, the quality piece comes back to, well, how contextualized is it? Have the players got enough repetition in context so that they can better understand where the solution that they're trying to implement finds itself within the nature of their game? And then finally, I think for me, it's just recognizing that, just building everything you said, Gerard. You know, we've got this coaching community here that we're looking to continue building. I mean, it's fascinating to see that, you know, in the last year or so of doing these spaces that we've had, I don't know, tens and thousands of coaches that have engaged with us. So, you know, Gerard, you know the stats better than I would, but just keep staying curious, stay engaging, stay communicating with all of us. Make sure you're following myself and Joe, because we've got loads of stuff coming up over the next few months. And obviously this is part of a series of spaces, that are FA accredited. So we'll be back. Not next Sunday. We'll be off next Sunday. We'll be back again in 2 weeks for part three of our series as we look to kind of build into, a webinar, which is going to be titled Developing a 360 Approach to One-on-Ones. So I've just shared a link in the comment section for that as well. If you're interested in engaging in that, please be reminded that all the FA accredited stuff that we're doing, does take the best part of 4 to 6 weeks for your hours to get submitted. I mean, to get uploaded. Following the submission from us, which usually takes place at the end of the month. So for instance, if you've done your CPD today and you've completed your self-reflection off the back of this one, you probably likely won't get your hours to the best part of end of June, first week of July, as these hours will go in at the end of May, just to give some context for those who are sometimes thinking it's taking a little bit long. So just clarity on that, it's the end of the month that the submission goes in, and then 4 to 6 weeks from that kind of point. So please bear that in mind. Make sure you're following us, both myself and Gerard. If you haven't caught the whole discussion, you can go back and listen to it on the Coaches Network podcast. So that's on all major platforms. And it gets released every Wednesday on there. You have until the end of the month to get your CPD reflections in. And that's inclusive of all the spaces sessions that we do in the month of May. And then final thing, I'm just going to, if you're just making sure that you're following my profile, I've just released the latest episode of a YouTube show that I'm involved in with a good friend of mine, called Coaching Conversations, where we basically have just literally that, coaching conversations. So anything and everything related to coaching, and we're discussing it in 20-25 minute bite-sized episodes. So check that out. Be posting some stuff on that. And guys, you know, stay curious. Until next time, guys, take care. Have a great evening. Sorry for the ramble, but I think it's just worth knowing that we're doing a great job here building a community, and we want it to continue. Good evening, everyone. Take care, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Yaz. This is top class. See you soon, guys. Thanks, Emmanuel and Rudy, for joining in as well.
there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.